Accession number 12165, Real 2.
Captain Massam, Real 2.
The Germans were overrunning Greece and were coming down towards Piraeus. We left Eleusis for Nauplia, and on the way there was a Blenheim aircraft circled low over us, followed by a German. Now, what type of German it was, I don't know. It was a fighter, probably a Messerschmitt, but I wasn't quite sure of what type it was. The Blenheim eventually was shot down very close to us. It commenced to settle in the water, and one man crawled out on a wing. By this time, we'd got close to him, and we had a lifeboat ready for lowering. I was sent away in this lifeboat to pick anybody up from the aircraft. We got the pilot on board and took him back to the ship. He said to us he didn't know what nationality the ship was because our ensign was so dirty. That was a ruse to make people not identify us. But when he heard us swearing, he knew we were Englishmen. We got him aboard, and the fighter came back to try and machine gun us. We let go with the 12-pounder, and we presume, or we claimed, we shot it down because he disappeared very rapidly and very low over the island of Hydra. And that was all we saw of him till there was a puff of black smoke came up behind the island. And we never knew if we'd been credited with him or not. The pilot was a New Zealander, and he said if he'd known what it was like to be machine gunned on a ship, he would never have done it himself before. So we arrived in Nauplia with the Ulster Prince, the Santa Clara Valley, and the Agios Georgio. The Ulster Prince was at Belfast cross-channel ferry boat. The Santa Clara Valley was the Smiths of Cardiff, and she was loaded with mules for the army. And the Greek, the Aeus Georgius, was loaded with landmines. We were getting short of boiler water by this time, so we dropped the anchor and waited for somebody to come out to us. Nobody came out to us, but the Santa Clara Valley next morning started unloading his mules. He'd got quite a few mules thrown into the water when the German dive bombers appeared. They hit the Ulster Prince, which was in harbour, loading troops. Then they hit the Santa Clara Valley, and she hadn't got all her mules off by then. And then the Greek, who had anchored well away from us, was hit also, and he went up in just one big cloud of smoke. We never saw or heard any more of him. The Cavallo was hit in the engine room and a near miss which fractured the propeller shaft. Whilst we were making an examination of the ship, a tank landing craft approached us with a naval officer on board, and he said we were to abandon the ship. The evacuation had been given up. So we did that. We took our lifeboats ashore. with the two desert rats with us, and the dog, and the New Zealand pilot. And we landed on a sandy beach late that afternoon, wondering what to do. We noticed that up on the cliff there was a cafe. So, having nowhere else to go, we made for the cafe. It was deserted. We spent the first night there, being warm weather. We didn't need blankets, we hadn't blankets. And in the morning, the captain and the chief officer went down into the village of Norplia. It was only a village then, I believe it's a big holiday resort now. And they contacted the STO, the Sea Transport Officer. There was a naval officer stationed in the village and was in charge of this evacuation. He said he couldn't do much for us, but if we went back to the village in the evening, there were plans for an airlift by Sunderland flying boats out of the bay for some of the men. And if we got in the queue, we might be able to get a seat or a standing room on the Sunderland flying boats. He said these flying boats had been stripped down of all their interior fittings. Nobody was allowed to take anything on there except what they stood up in, usually a pair of underpants and a shirt. And they were hoping to get them to Crete. Well, we were given the choice as to try and get on in the queue or not. We didn't fancy this. It didn't sound too good to us. So we remained in the cafe and we spent the second night at the cafe. We reported again to the village and they told us that we had to be on the beach after sunset and we would be taken off.
Who told you this?
The Sea Transport Officer in the village. So we went down onto the beach after dark. We got in this long queue. We had our Desert Rat and our Air Force pilot with us. And we were taken off by small boats to HMS Orion. Going up the gangway of the Orion, everything was thrown overboard except our arms and our clothes. The Desert Rat was told he couldn't take his dog with him. He said, if he doesn't go, I don't go. And he was quite prepared to turn around and go back ashore. But the master at arms on the Orion's gangway said, hurry up and get yourself out of sight. So we kept our Desert Rat and we kept his dog. We were bombed next morning and the Orion was hit. One of the turrets got a direct hit and killed all the men in it. But we landed at Suda Bay and the Orion went back for more.
What was it like when the bomb struck the Orion?
Well, it was just a terrific compression. Everything seemed to come down on top of you, but actually it didn't. The air cleared again after that. I'd spent the night in an officer's cabin, with other chaps, of course, laid on the deck. Both the armchairs were taken up, so I was only third mate. I had to lie on the deck. And we landed next day at Suda Bay.
Which was the worst, the bombing of the Orion or the bombing of the Kavala?
I think the Orion, for power. The bombing of the Cavallo, one bomb went down into a coal bunker and dissipated its force among the coal. And the other stick, there were usually three bombs in a stick from a Stuka. The other stick landed just under the stern and fractured the propeller and its shaft. That was taken up by the water. So to have three bombs hit a warship's armoured turret probably didn't go through. It was just a concussion that killed the men in the turret. And you felt that all through the ship. The first day in Suda Bay, we tried to make contact with somebody in authority, but nobody wanted us. The Air Force said, "You aren't Air Force." The Army said, "Well, we can't do anything for you." And the Navy said, "Well, if you hang about, we'll see what we can do." So we wandered away from the harbour, which was being bombed, to spend the night in a cave. As we lay in this cave and looked up, you could see huge cracks in the roof of it. And I just wondered, if we got a near miss there, if the whole lot would collapse. Anyway, it didn't. Next day we wandered about and saw that there was no chance of anybody being taken off from Suda Bay, certainly not us. So we wandered off into the hills. Well, I say the hills, I meant away from the bay. It was higher up. And we found a farm. And we thought we would stay near that farm till the morning. One of the army chaps, one of the desert rats, wandered around on his own and came back and he said, "There's a rabbit in the hutch at that farm. So do you fancy a rabbit stew?" So two of us, myself and another young lad, we went with him. And when we neared the farm, the dog started barking. Oh, he said, "I'll fix that." He takes his Jack Russell out of his battle dress, said something to it like, "Go, boy, go." And the Jack Russell went to the farm, to where the dog was barking. And whether the dog in the farm was a bitch, I don't know. But anyway, the Jack Russell quietened him down. The soldier, in his best military manner, crawled up to the rabbit hutch, grabbed the rabbit, and we were away. We cooked that rabbit in a petrol tin over an open fire, which was laid two rifle barrels to stand the petrol tin on. And as we hadn't had anything to eat for 2 days, that was a very welcome meal. So seeing that it was not going to be any good staying around Suda Bay, we started to walk. That night we came across, up in the hills, a small cemetery. Now the Greeks, the Cretans, when they bury their people, they dig a vault in the ground and they lay the coffins in racks and they put a slab of rocks or stone over the top. And when there's a funeral, they take the slab off and put another body in. We found this tomb. We slid the stone back. We turned a few coffins off the shelves. And we slept in that tomb, as it were, all that night. By this time, there were only, I think, five of us left. There was two soldiers. The New Zealand pilot had joined his Air Force colleagues to be taken off. And we decided that, as they said, the evacuation was now taking place on the south coast of Crete, we would try and get there. The fourth night, we were up in the hills. We came across a river. The water was icy cold, but we were glad of a wash. and we fell in with some New Zealand and Australian troops who said we could carry on with them. They fed us bully beef and biscuits and blackberry jam. That's all they had, and they shared it with us. The local Greeks were very sympathetic to us. The old ladies especially seemed pleased to see us, although we couldn't do anything for them. The men thrust all their Greek money onto us. They knew that the Germans would take it, so they gave it to us. It turned out it was no use to us. It had gone out of circulation in Egypt anyway, and we might as well have papered the walls with it. The wandering down wasn't too bad, being downhill. And we got down to the coast and made our way to a little place called Spakia, where they were evacuating troops from. We were lucky there. We got aboard a Lamport and Holt ship called the Delane. She was pretty full of troops when we got aboard her. And I laid on the hatch with one of the derricks above me. And you might think it funny, but I felt safe underneath that derrick. I thought, well, if the Germans come with their dive bombers, they won't see me underneath this derrick. We were aboard that ship 3 days, I believe, 2 nights probably, and we landed in Alexandria.
Who did this SS Delane belong to?
Lamport and Holt, a oh, Liverpool yeah. firm.
Lamport?
Lamport, yeah. So we landed in Alexandria, and on the quay we were received and given a mug of tea and a sandwich by no other than the Salvation Army. They were the only people who seemed to bother with us. But we were taken to a hotel, a small private hotel, 4 of us, and there we were bathed and told to make our way to the place called the Fleet Club, which was the Royal Navy's recreation centre for Alexandria. At the Fleet Club, they issued us with some clothes and some money, and they told us to get ourselves a suitcase and spend our money and go back to the hotel and wait for further orders. The orders eventually came to the hotel, and we went by train to Suez. Now, this was quite a long journey, especially laid on the floor of a guard's van, with a desert sandstorm blowing through the cracks of the door and covering everybody and everything with sand. But we did arrive in Suez. We were taken down to the quay in Suez and put aboard iron lighters. There were all sorts of people by this time. There were troops, there were other merchant seamen who'd lost their ships, a lot of Dutchmen from the troop ships that had been sunk. They were Dutch and the crews were Dutch. And we were left in these lighters in the blazing sun, which was like sitting in a roasting pan, and then taken out at night to the Duchess of Athol. That was another troop ship who'd come round the Cape with troops. She was a Canadian Pacific steamer built for the North Atlantic passenger trade. There was plenty of room on her, but there were no facilities for hot weather. She'd been built for rough winters across the Atlantic, and she was now in the Gulf, in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Suez. Eventually sea sailed. But nobody ever told us when we would go, because we couldn't get off the ship. We should be there anyway when she sailed. And all we knew was when she started to move, we were sailing. Her first stop was at Aden. It was hotter than Suez, I think. We weren't allowed off. From Aden, she went across to Mombasa. We did get a breeze in Mombasa, but we weren't allowed ashore. The Duchess of Athol was loading copper ingots for home. From Mombasa, we went down to Durban, and nobody could have kept us aboard the ship in Durban. The South Africans queued up at the bottom of the gangway in motor cars to take us out, to wine us and dine us, and take us on trips, bathing. And that glorious honeymoon lasted 3 days. The Duchess of Athol sailed for Cape Town. Cape Town wasn't as friendly as Durban had been. We could wander ashore, but nobody seemed to bother about us much. When loading was finished in Cape Town, we sailed. We didn't know where we were going. It was rather uncomfortable in those little cabins. So most of us slept on deck. And we ended up in Trinidad. Now this Duchess of Athol could row. I've been on some ships that could row, but there's nobody like the drunken Duchess, as they called her. Everything went from one side of the ship to the other. If you were sat in an armchair, your armchair went and you went with it. It was only the tables that were screwed down. So if you were walking, you hung onto a table while she rolled away back again. From Trinidad, we went up to Halifax, Nova Scotia. Nova Scotia was a convoy, Halifax, Nova Scotia was a convoy port for the North Atlantic, so we knew then we should soon be home. We sailed from Halifax and we landed in Greenock. From Greenock, we were put on a train to Glasgow and given a ticket to our home port, which was Hull. The first night was spent on York Station, asleep on a pile of mail bags, hanging onto your suitcase. And we arrived in Hull. I can give you the date, I think. We arrived in Hull at night in June 1941. To find the city that we knew in ruins. The big store had disappeared.
Which big store was that?
Hammond's, in front of the station. It had disappeared in the bombing. They'd had some terrible bombing. And I stayed the night with one of the chaps who'd travelled all the way from the ship with me. When we'd been deciding what we were going to do in Crete, he said, well, I'm coming with you, I'm sticking with you. So I went, he lived on Beverly Road. He took me to his parents' house, and I stayed the night there on a settee in his mother's house. I went down to the bus station next morning to find out how I could get to Leven, where I lived. I stayed with aunt and uncle in Leven for many years. I was sat on the top of a bus. All I had was my suitcase and my civvy suit that I'd been issued with in Egypt. There was a large lady behind me on a bus, on the top of the bus. She took it on herself to walk along the bus to where I was sat and said, why aren't you in the army? My son's fighting for the such as you. And I said, Mommy might be. And I'm going home. And that was the end of the Crete episode.
So was she very unpleasant about it?
Yes, she was unpleasant. She thought I was a deserter or something. So after that, I joined the Guido, another of the Wilson Line ships. And we did three voyages to the West Indies at the height of the U-boat war. And we made it safely. She was lost the following voyage off Cape Hatteras.
Were you with her then?
No, I'd left her. I did three voyages and then she was sunk on the subsequent voyage.
How much contact with the enemy did you have on the Guido?
Well, only submarine alarms when the convoys were attacked in the Atlantic, because everybody was concerned with that. You watch ships round you going down, and you watch men being picked up out of the water, but because you weren't allowed to stop your ship, and there was nothing else you could do but steam on.
How frightening was it?
That was one of the most frightening things, because you never knew when it was going to happen. You could be asleep in your bed or on your settee. We didn't go to bed usually. You'd be asleep fully dressed on your settee and you'd hear the start of it. Or some poor fellas were up on watch trying to keep station and they didn't know what had hit them.
But did you think it was always going to be you who would be the next one, or did you think that you were invulnerable?
No, I always thought I'd make it. I always thought I'd get through. I took all the precautions, of course, as I say. We didn't take our clothes off and we didn't bath. We just washed as best we could. And we had our, what we call our hurry-up bag, a small bag with our personal possessions, things like this in.
Your certificate of discharge?
No, that's discharge, yes. Well, we had certificates of competency, you see, which we carried with us as well. And any personal papers. It couldn't be much, because you had to carry it with you if anything happened. Into a boat or swim with it if you wanted it. When you got out, you had to carry it. So after the three voyages in the Guido, I was sent to join the Spiro.
When would this have been about?
I joined the Spiro in October 1942. The Spiro was a partly refrigerated ship. She belonged to the same company as I'd been working for. There was nothing startling about her except that she could carry 12 passengers. Her job was to take frozen meat to the garrison in Gibraltar. And this we did for 4 voyages. After discharging the cargo in Gibraltar, the frozen meat, the potatoes, the army stores, radio sets, everything they wanted in Gibraltar, we would go up to Lisbon to load. Now, the Portuguese weren't in the war at that time. They were friendly